You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
Everyone these days could use a little support, and your friends at the ESO Network are no different. With the ESO Network Patreon, the cool thing is when you help support us, it's you who will benefit. With four tiers starting for as little as 25 cents a week, you can listen to some of your favorite network podcasts early, hear exclusive content, maybe get some ESO swag, or even possibly take a shot at the geek seat. All you need to do is sign up at patreon.com/ESO Network.
I'm Drew Leiter.
And I'm Cletus Jacobs.
And welcome to episode 244 of the Earth Station DCU. Tonight we're going to talk the next Batman Second Son number 9, Batman the Detective number 3, Batman Urban Legends number 4, Far Sector number 12, Future State Gotham number 2, Justice League Last Ride number 2, Rorschach number 9, The Joker number 4, Detective Comics 1037, Wonder Woman 773, Batwoman Season 2 Episode 15, Armed and Dangerous, Superman and Lois Season 1 Episode 9, Loyal Subjects, The Flash Season 7 Episode 12, Goodbye Vibrations, and DC's Legends of Tomorrow Season 6 Episode 5, The Satanist Apprentice. But before we get into that, let's talk some DC news. Alright, Cletus, first up for DC news. Gene Luen Wang's well-received Batman-Superman run is being cut short, as DC has announced his run and the series will be ending with September's Batman-Superman number 22.
This is, I'd say, slightly surprising, only because Batman and Superman are more likely to be successful, obviously, than other DC titles. That being said, it's like their, like, what, fifth book? And we know DC is seriously, seriously trimming the fat on their titles. So I'm bummed. I'm quite liking the run that we're reading right now, but I'm also not entirely shocked to see it go.
Yeah, I'm not that shocked either. What we've read of it has been pretty good. So I'm sad to see it go, but I'm not surprised either because we've had several of these Batman Superman titles over the years. All right, moving on to our next bit of DC news. This September, writer Chuck Brown will be working with artist Valentine de Londro on a 6-issue Black Manta series for DC. No details have been released yet about the series. I was surprised they're doing a Black Manta limited series. Of all the stuff they could do, I was, you know, surprised they picked Black Manta. But I don't know if they're doing this because of the Aquaman movie that's supposed to be coming out. But it seems kind of early to be doing that.
I don't know. I mean, they might be putting it out in hopes that they can have the trade ready for the movie.
Yeah, that would make sense.
I mean, Black Manta is not necessarily my favorite villain. I do like stories usually involved with him because he is pretty cool. He's got a cool design. But this is the right way to do it. I love the miniseries idea. I'm never going to criticize these because worst case scenario, it doesn't sell that well and it's over in 6 issues. Not really anything lost.
And with miniseries, like you said, you can put it out there. And if it does well, you can do another miniseries. If it doesn't, then it's over.
Yep. And you're going to get consistent artwork because there's really no reason to rush them. I mean, not that they wouldn't do that, but there's not... It's not as big of a need to do that because it's not coming out, you know, every month for an indefinite amount of time. It's just 6 issues. You've got the same creators, theoretically, unless something goes catastrophically wrong. And you just put it out and you just get, in a sense, the ideal version of a 6-issue story that they'd like to tell. And they're not worrying about setting other things up or getting it out on a regular schedule or incorporating different artists or whatever. They're just telling their six-issue story. So, like I said, it's not necessarily one that I'm drooling over in excitement, but I'm also, I like the idea. I like that DC is doing this.
All right, up next for DC News, Aquaman 2 director James Wan reveals the film's official title, Aquaman and the Lost Kingdom.
That was definitely hinted at in the last movie. So, not something I would have necessarily predicted, but totally makes sense based on some of the, like, various directions with the world that they built in the first film that they could have gone.
Agreed. All right, up next for DC News, the Flash movie director Andy Muschietti reveals the first look at Supergirl's costume, which is basically just the S emblem. So I don't know why this was big news, but I kind of saw it all over the place.
And it's understandably so. It's the same S emblem and design as the you know, their Superman logo from this current version of Superman, which makes total sense. So you're really the only thing that's different is it looks like she's going to have some sort of, like, her shoulders are going to be red, like we've seen in some versions of her costume, which is cool. And that, but that's also, like, the hardest part to see of that whole thing.
So, yeah, I saw it. Hey, yeah, that's cool. But I wasn't that impressed. maybe we want to get a picture of the whole costume. Be looking cooler.
Yeah, it's one of those things, like, you get why they do it and why they put it out there. But it also, again, if it had simply just been a zoomed in picture of Henry Cavill's costume, there wouldn't be that big of a difference between the two. Again, really, the only thing would be the red that's on the upper half of it. So it's cool because it's for maybe some people didn't know that Supergirl was going to be in the movie, or it's confirmation that she really is going to be in the movie. And so, you know, it's whatever. It's neat. I'm excited to see the full version of it.
I am too. Now, a new rumor claims that Grant Gustin will reprise his role as the Flash for the upcoming Flash movie. Maybe make a cameo or something. But I haven't seen anything substantial on that, just rumors.
I mean, it wouldn't surprise me. I mean, especially given that we had the reverse of that happen in the Crisis crossover. It would make sense. It'd be cool. I mean, there's, again, it's one of those things. As a cameo, worst case, it's a forgettable scene, but that's not that big of a deal. So there's really nothing to lose by doing it.
Yeah, I agree with you. All right, saw the Titans Season 3 trailer, and it looks like Titans is returning in August 12th. And I'm excited about that because I'm ready to move on from CW shows, and I'm sure you are too.
God, so ready. one thing that really interests me in this trailer, Drew, I just assumed that they were going to have Jason become Red Hood, you know, just like because he was pissed at the Titans and Batman. It seems like they're still doing the getting the crap beat out of him with a crowbar by the Joker, which I was very honestly surprised by. I really didn't think they were going to go that route with this version.
Yeah, I agree with you. I was surprised by that too. And it looks like, from seeing the trailer, this looks like it's going to be really Bat-central, even more than we've seen in past seasons of the Titans.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of gave up a while ago on not having that. I don't know. It's just, it's not just, this show is not the only thing that's guilty of it. DC, Warner Brothers, I don't know if it's AT&T at this point, whoever, they just, I don't know if we can escape that reality, Drew. You know what I mean? Like, it's just, this is how it's going to be with DC stuff anymore. But even the Flash movie, one of the biggest, not that I'm not excited about it, to be clear, but one of the biggest selling points of that is Michael Keaton as Batman.
I got to tell you, I'm one that's very excited about the Michael Keaton thing because I love that original movie with him and Jack Nicholson, just because I find it very funny. But
I have absolutely no complaints about it. It is exciting, and I totally get why people would be, as I am. But nonetheless, it is a Batman character featuring in a Flash movie. So it's just, it is what it is.
Exactly. All right, for our next bit of DC news, Stargirl Season 2 trailer reveals Alan Scott's daughter Jade is making an appearance. I was very surprised by that, and I was very happy to see some look like energy constructs in the trailer. Very excited about that.
One thing I am excited, and I agree with you. One thing I am wondering, I feel foolish that we didn't think of Jade. I don't think that we thought of Jade when we were talking about season one, and I feel foolish for not thinking of that. But B, I wonder, it almost seems like they might be going with just like sort of a green fire. And I wonder if that's how they're going to get around having to do constructs all the time, if it's just going to end up being more of just like a green, because that's kind of what we saw hints of in season one, and that's what we saw more of in the trailer. So I almost wonder if it's not going to be like what we're used to with the normal Green Lanterns. And to be fair, Jade isn't, you know, a space Green Lantern. I almost wonder if that's what we're going to get instead, is mainly like green fire.
It could be. At least we're getting something. At least we're moving in the right direction.
And again, it's one of those things where it kind of, I'm honestly more okay with that, because Jade's not, you know what I mean? Like I'd be more annoyed if and when Diggle ever shows up as a Green Lantern in the CW shows. I'm sure it won't be great. I'd love to be wrong about that. But like, if that was purely a green fire thing, that would annoy me, right? Because he's supposed to be, you know, the modern space version of a Green Lantern who uses constructs. But Jade's not that. So it really wouldn't bother me nearly as much.
So, and we know John Diggle is supposed to be making some appearances coming up soon on the CW show. So it'll be interesting to see how they portray him, if we even get a Green Lantern, which I'm doubting, actually.
I'm not. I know it's, you know, it's certainly a possibility, but I'm not filled with confidence.
I'm not either. All right, up next for DC News, the Arrowverse shows will return Wednesday, October 13th, with Legends of Tomorrow Season 7 and Batwoman Season 3. Season 8 of The Flash will premiere Tuesday, November 16th, and Stargirl Season 3, Superman and Lois Season 2, and Naomi Season 1 will all premiere mid-season. So, no release dates on those yet.
It's crazy to me. I one thing I'm curious with these shows is if it's going to be a little bit weird with the actors in terms of, like, their jobs. Because normally they have, like, an off-season, so to speak, almost like athletes. I wonder if they're going to... I don't know. Like, I don't know how much of these... Obviously, the shows are further ahead in filming than they are coming out, as is always the case. But I'm curious specifically how far ahead the shows are, because they're going much deeper into the summer than they've ever gone before, for reasons that we all understand. And so part of me wonders if that's also going to end up cutting into the amount of time that they would normally get off.
I bet it will, because, shoot, we got some shows going, like Supergirl coming back in August, which is really weird. And then, of course, her show's ending. But still, we got shows starting back up in October when they normally would. I don't know. It's just weird. So, yeah, you're right. I'm guessing they're not going to get that much of a break. Of course, they had a long break during COVID.
That's true.
All right. And for our last bit of DC news, on Monday, June 28th, The 42 Cast, episode 115, will feature an interview with Bill Duke, the actor that played Agent O'Dell from Black Lightning. So, I'm excited for checking out the 42 Cast episode. So, I'm interested in hearing Nathan's interview with Bill Duke. I'm sure that'll be really interesting.
Yeah, that's awesome. That's a really, really cool opportunity. Yeah. I'm definitely excited to check it out. I'll be curious. I don't know if he's allowed to share anything because the show didn't get picked up. Really curious to hear how much he was supposed to be involved in the Painkiller spinoff.
Yeah, that'd be really interesting. And I don't know exactly when Nathan interviewed him. If it was before Black Lightning ended or after, I don't know. Or if it was before or after the announcement of Painkiller 2. I guess we'll find out when we listen to the episode, but I'll be excited to check it out. All right, well, that wraps up DC News for this week. Let's take a short break, and when we come back, we'll do our comics talk.
The 42 cast is turning 100, but like all good things, it must come to an end. Tune in to our epic finale as we see who lives, who dies, and who gets their own spinoff. And then come back when the 42 cast is back for season 2 with even more segments, more guests, and more of explaining why Ryan is wrong. It's why we're still the ultimate answer to fandom, geekiness, and everything. You can only find all this awesome by downloading the 42 cast, a proud member of the ESO Network.
And we're back! But before we get into this week's comic books talk, gotta let you know, there's gonna be spoilers.
We got spoilers.
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 We got spoilers.
Spoilers
for you. We got spoilers.
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 We've got spoilers.
Spoilers
for you. For you.
All right, let's talk the next Batman, Second Son, number 9. Mrs. Fox stops Tim's statement. She states he's answered truthfully. Any other aspects of the incident, no criminal charges were ever filed. Renee Montoya has a discussion with Adriana Chubb in the police garage. Renee wants Adriana to have a discussion with her partner Whitaker about following the rules because masks are about to be outlawed. In the flashback, Tim talks to Lucius about running over the man. Lucius states he will handle it and proceeds to leak certain facts to the media that make the victim look bad. Tim Fox is sent to military school for troubled teens for the rich, and it looks like this is where he will learn his skills to become the next Batman.
I'm definitely enjoying us starting to dig more into Jace/Tim's background. Definitely curious to dig more into that story. One thing I do want to talk about, Drew, and it goes with this and also in the Lucius Fox story that we get in one of the other Batman titles we read this week. We're really going on this writer's version of the Fox family is clearly what DC is going forward with, which is I have no problem with. But it's interesting to me because he clearly has a very different version of Fox than I've ever read or seen portrayed in other media. And I'm a little bit surprised that DC's just kind of okay with it because in my opinion, it's a serious character assassination of the guy. I mean, morally gray is being generous, I feel like.
I agree with you. I mean, I haven't seen this version of Lucius Fox before either. And it just, reading it, it just feels weird.
And then in the other story, and again, it's not in this comic, but in a later comic that we're going to talk about, the focus is, again, it's the same writer, and the focus is on Lucius again. And in that, we're getting this sort of retcon, in my view, retcon of Lucius's willingness to work with the Bat family in the first place. And it's sort of, I feel like he's retconning it to fit his vision and version of the Fox family to sort of explain what we're getting with Lucius Fox is if you assume that Lucius is the character in the past that we'd always read, and now all of a sudden he's like, it doesn't totally make sense. So now he's gone back and we get this version that isn't really a fan of Bruce and doesn't like what he's doing, but helps anyway. It's fascinating. Again, I don't necessarily have a problem with it because it's not like this is a character that DC's done a ton with. I mean, I'd rather them do something than nothing. But I'm just surprised because it feels like a really serious heel turn.
Yeah, and we'll talk more about that when we get to the other story. All right, let's move on to our next title for this week, Batman the Detective number 3. The episode opens up in Paris, France, where Batman brings Henry Ducard into a local hospital after he's been shot 4 times. We get a flashback to Bruce Wayne's training with Ducard, and Bruce's first lesson is that manhunting is a nighttime job. Ducard teaches him how to watch, how to follow, and how to detect people who are trying not to leave a trace. They took people in together, and Ducard seems to have friends everywhere. Bruce goes after a criminal alone and gets captured. Henry shows up and rescues him, and Henry ends up shooting the bad guy, and Bruce gets very angry. They have a fight, and then Ducard disappears. The issue ends with Bruce Wayne being arrested for the murder of Henry Ducard.
I was a little bummed by this issue, not because it was bad by any means. I mean, it's the same, I feel like, quality we've been getting in the story. But I don't know that we needed this. This felt like a, I mean, isn't this generally the version of Batman and Ducard that we normally get? Like, did we need that backstory?
Not really. I don't think we did. I mean, to me, it felt like it derailed from the story.
It's a six-issue. My problem is that it's a six-issue miniseries. If this was an ongoing title, I would think nothing of it. I would have absolutely no complaints because it is a good issue of a comic, to be clear. But as 1/6 of the overall story, I'm not convinced that it was 1/6 important to the plot. You know what I mean? I don't know that we needed that because it's, I know not everybody's going to be very familiar with Ducard and Batman, but I mean, I don't know. I'm a little bit surprised they dedicated a full issue to it.
You're not the only one. I thought that we're seeing something we've seen before. So, and to me, it kind of took away from the overall story because we focused on this so much and kind of got away from what was going on in the other issues. So
I very much agree. I thought it really tripped the momentum of the title. I also, and this is a minor nitpick, but I really do not like the way the artist depicts Bruce out of costume. I'm sorry, but that man is obviously Batman. I know it's comics and we're supposed to suspend our disbelief, but the way they draw Bruce out of costume, that's Batman. I don't know how you could not think that.
All right, well, let's move on to our next title for this week. Batman Urban Legends number 4. Our first story in this is Red Hood and Batman in Cheer Part 4 of 6. The issue opens up with a flashback to a death in the family storyline. Batman tells Jason not to take on the Joker by himself, and of course, Jason doesn't listen. In the present, Red Hood is being attacked by Mr. Freeze. The ice weakens the floor, and Red Hood falls through. When Red Hood tries to go outside, Freeze has blocked all the exits with ice. Then Freeze shoots Red Hood with his gun. Before Jason was frozen, Jason called Oracle asking for Batman's assistance. Batman tracks down Jason and finds him in the back of a truck that is obviously a trap. Batman is able to get Red Hood out of the back of the truck. Batman tries to stop Freeze but has to go back after Jason because Freeze's men are about to shoot him. When Batman saves Red Hood, Freeze sneaks up on him and shoots him from behind. A new smiley face villain introduces himself. One thing I noticed about this issue was Jason seemed to be surprised that Batman came back for him, as opposed to how he felt in Death in the Family. At least I thought the writer did a good job of showing Jason being surprised about that.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I continue to really enjoy this story. I like I mentioned when we started this series, I like Zdarsky as a both writer and artist. This story is interesting to me because I'm not that he hasn't written serious stories, but I'm not used to reading those kinds. And it's just impressive to me that he can execute a very dramatic story like the one that we're getting while, I don't know, maintaining the quality that I'm used to seeing in his more comedic titles.
And I gotta say, the flashbacks to A Death in the Family seem very accurate to me.
Extremely.
I wouldn't be surprised if he had the sucker open when he was writing this. So.
It's one of the things you'd almost hope so, right? why wouldn't you do that?
So, I just thought it was very well done.
Yeah.
All right, well, let's move on to our next story, which is Batman and Superman Punch. Bruce Wayne is out of town, so Luke suits up as Batwing and goes after the Riddler. Batwing goes into the sewer tunnels and finds Riddler's next riddle. There's 13 crates, and one of them has the bomb. Men keep popping out of random crates trying to kill Batwing as Luke tries to solve the riddle. As Luke solves the puzzle, Riddler opens one last crate, Killer Croc, and Batwing fights Killer Croc until they've come to a resolution. If Killer Croc can take Batwing to Riddler's hideout, Batwing will give him a head start to get away.
I didn't totally care about this story, to be honest with you. It was fine. There just wasn't a whole lot of purpose, I didn't think. I get kind of what they were... I felt like the moral of the story, so to speak, was like him softening on the idea of Jace being home. But I don't know. Did we really need that? Like, I feel like you could have just put that in the main title.
That's true. Yeah. This story to me was fine also. It just felt like we kind of got thrown in the middle of something and that was it.
Yeah, it just felt like it just didn't seem to have much consequence. Like, it just didn't seem to matter to me that much what was going on. Again, it felt like it was there to introduce the idea of Luke maybe not hating 100% the fact that Jace is back in Gotham. But I don't know that we needed that. It felt more so to me like the story was there because they needed to fill about 5 or 6 pages.
I have to agree with you on that. And it did feel like its purpose was to, you know, make him more comfortable with Jace being back. I have to agree with you that, because that kind of felt like what it was. All right, let's move on to our next story here. Tim Drake and Some of Our Parts, Part 1 of 3. Tim Drake is working on a missing persons case when Oracle calls. She's having problems with the Bat computer system, and since Tim built it, needs his help. Tim confirms he's Robin while Damian's out of town. He's not too happy with Barbara about bringing up Ivy Town University and tells her to stop talking to his ex about him. Tim learns that the missing girl he is searching for was into something called the Chaos Monster. Now we see Tim meets an old friend for dinner, Bernard. And during dinner, the Chaos Monster shows up. Bernard hides under the table while Tim tries to fight the monster. The monster seems to be quicker and has chloroform powder he shoots at Tim. When Tim wakes up, the police tell him that Bernard has been kidnapped.
Well, how excited for a Tim Drake story were you?
I was very excited for a Tim Drake story. I kind of like the fact that they clarified what they're calling Tim now. He's going by Robin because Damien's out of town. If Damien comes back, I don't know what the heck they're going to call him. But right now, he's Robin. Why is Tim and Stephanie not dating now? All of a sudden, they're exes. I'm like... Are we going to get any story background on this? Happened off panel, apparently. I'm curious about that because not too long ago, they were dating when they were in Young Justice. So that seemed weird to me. I don't know if they're ever going to explain it.
That was weird. It's one of those things, like, surely the editorial team would have caught it if that wasn't meant to be right. So clearly that was an intentional line, but it didn't, like you said, there's, to my knowledge, the last comic we saw, they were dating still.
Yep. Unless you count Future State, which I don't.
That's almost what I wonder. I almost wonder if they're just going off of Future State and they're just like, well, they weren't dating in Future State, so that's what it is. Which,
yeah, that's stupid.
It's stupid, but I honestly, Drew, I can't rule it out.
And I do not remember this Bernard character, so he must have been from a time when I wasn't collecting comics.
Or he's made up for the story.
That could be too, but my gut tells me he was... Well, I thought there was an editorial note that said he was from Robin Volume 2 series.
Oh, did he? Okay, yeah, I might have missed that.
So it's not a character I was familiar with. If they would have had Ives in there, I would have been familiar with him. That's early Robin. But I enjoyed the story. It's probably not the best story, but I'm still happy to see a Tim Drake story, and I wish I'd get more of them. I wish he'd have his own series. All right, moving on to our last story in this issue, Grifter in the Long Con, Part 4 of 5. We get a flashback of Cole getting approached by Leviathan to kill Lucius Fox. In the present, Deathstroke is fighting Grifter. That's just pretend. We find out Grifter and Deathstroke are working together, and Grifter has a plan to catch Batman. But instead of Batman, Grifter catches Superman, and Deathstroke hightails it out of there when he finds that out. At the Wayne building, intruders are after Lucius Fox. The Zealot shows up instead of Grifter to save Lucius. Grifter teleports away from Superman before Superman can catch him. Superman tells Batman they should work together, but Batman says he can handle Grifter and tells Superman to go back to Metropolis. And I'm guessing you didn't even read that story that in depth.
I skimmed it. I saw the events that you described.
I don't know. Of all the parts we've read so far, this one kept my interest the most. So that's basically all I got to say about it.
I mean, that makes sense. We're too deep into the story, and I just haven't cared about enough of them whatever. You know what I mean? It's too late for me.
Yeah, I understand totally. All right, let's move on to our next title for this week. Far Sector number 12. With the fleet ready to bombard the city, Jo makes her way aboard the lead ship, and she's able to convince the captain to stand down. The city was still in the middle of a referendum, and officials got the servers back up and running so that the AT could vote like everybody else. The referendum passed with a clear majority, and the city's emotionless days will officially be over. Without the fleet captain's support, and with the ground forces neutralized, the coup is over. Ex-counselor at Blaze of Glory will be tried for treason. Counselor Stump is out, resigned amid questions about irregularities. With her gone, the order to arrest Marth has been rescinded. Jo gets a message from her father telling her that she is not alone. And the issue ends with Jo reciting the Green Lantern Oath.
I think one thing that hurt my satisfaction with the last couple issues is the length of reading this month to month with the long gaps in between. You know, as we go along, my memory of some of the early issues has gotten a little bit fuzzy. And so I have to remind myself more with the plot, especially I was almost like I, on the one hand, I appreciated that it didn't summarize anything. But on the other hand, I was like, but I kind of needed it this time. I thought it was fine. I was a little surprised how they chose to kind of wrap it up mostly off screen or off page, I guess you could say. But it was fine. I didn't really have any complaints about that. I do feel slightly unsatisfied with what feels like a lack of resolution on the origin of her ring. Like we know it came from a guardian. I guess I was expecting more. I thought that was going to play into the story much more than it did.
I was disappointed by that also, because I thought it was going to play into the story a lot more. I think we were both excited about that, and it didn't really. And I don't know. I don't know if we're going to get a conclusion to that in the regular Green Lantern series that's going on now, because she seems like she's going to be a part of that. But I don't know if they're going to explore about her ring being different any more than they did. I'm hoping they do, but my gut tells me they're not.
I would assume it's either got to come up in the main Green Lantern title, or they're planning on doing a volume 2, which I would love. I would love to get that. But I don't know how you can just kind of leave that there. I feel like we got enough info. And again, it doesn't need to be the focus of the story. I liked the plot being about this new planet that we don't know anything about. That was cool and refreshing. But I was surprised that we didn't get more with it. Overall, I really liked this series, and I definitely intend to reread it as a whole. It's one of the better Green Lantern stories I've read in a while. So that was good. I have to admit, I feel a little surprised I didn't like the ending as much as I thought I was going to. It felt a little, I don't know what the right word is, loose or just not quite what I was expecting.
And my gut tells me we're not going to get a second miniseries of this. It feels like they're moving Joe into the main Green Lantern title, and that's where we're going to see her more of her story unfold.
That almost might end up being a loss, to be completely honest with you. Like, on the one hand, it's great, right? Because she's being incorporated into the main DC world, which is good in theory for her longevity. But that's right now. And what happens in a year when DC reboots for the umpteenth time? Does she stick? I don't know. You know, we don't know that she won't be Baz at some point.
Yeah, that's true. Right now, Baz isn't even a Green Lantern. He's a dude with a gun.
But he is actually, present again, which has been not the case for very long stretches of time. And again, that's fine. I'm sure he's not a lot of people's favorite Green Lantern, but he was created nonetheless for a reason, and they've done next to nothing with him. Clearly, that's not the case right now for Joe, and maybe it won't ever be the case. But if she survives on these miniseries, you're at least getting guaranteed books focused exclusively on her. And I almost worry that there's a chance. Again, it might not happen. There's a chance that even though integrating her into the main universe is theoretically good for the longevity of her character, it might end up ultimately leaving her in the dust at some point.
Yeah, that's true. One of the problems with the Green Lantern titles is there's too many human Green Lanterns.
Way too many. And they keep making more. That's the other thing that's driving me nuts. It's like, to be fair, Joe is different than any other Green Lantern they've made, and they made her ring different. So like, I can appreciate what they're doing with her. And the same thing with Kid Lantern, but at the same time, it's like, but are they different enough to not use some of these other people? I don't know. I do feel like we've hit our limit. I don't know what's left. You know what I mean? Like, what else? I hope, and I'm sure it won't be, but I kind of hope we've reached our cap on Human Lanterns.
Yeah, I agree with you. There's way too many of them now. And just trying to shuffle them around to get them all attention is hard enough. I have a feeling that eventually some of them are going to get killed off.
Or just, bazed, where they just don't exist. We just don't acknowledge their existence.
Yeah. Well, we're going to be seeing Baz teaming up with Joe for a while, so.
Right, which is cool. It's just one of those things, like, I don't necessarily, like, it's frustrating, but I can't necessarily blame DC when you've got 8 Human Lanterns. How are you supposed to juggle that? It's impossible.
Yep, totally agree.
I mean, they can't even handle 2 Flashes.
All right, well, let's move on to our next title for this week. Future State Gotham number 2. The Peacekeeper Red fights Nightwing and the Bat Family. That is until the Magistrate shows up. Jason tells the family to get out of there, and he's going after the next Batman, and they better stay out of his way. Jason talks to Bruce Wayne, telling him he needs to come back. Bruce said he has a bigger plan in place, and he's trying to link the next Batman to the Magistrate. Peacekeeper Red goes to Blackgate Penitentiary and finds the next Batman, who states he was not behind the bombing. Suddenly, all the prison doors open and the criminals are set free. I'm not sure how I feel about this Future State story. I'm intrigued with sort of what's going on, but then again, I'm not.
My negative feelings aren't tied so much to the story itself, so much as how lazy it feels. Like, we talked, I felt even more strongly about it this issue. And again, I it's possible I'm wrong and I'm just misinterpreting what they're doing. But this feels like a story that didn't get finished in time, and they're just throwing it out there now just to, at least make a couple bucks off of it. Because correct me if I'm wrong, Drew, on the backup story, we read that story, right? It felt very familiar. but just not inked or colorized, I guess you should say.
You mean the next Batman where he gets beat by the crowbar? That's because it's the second part of the story from last issue. That's why you remember it.
Oh, it just seemed so familiar. I was like, I swear I've read this story. Okay. Okay. That makes sense. I was like, man, this is wildly familiar. It just didn't stick. I don't know. It just had, I don't know about you, Drew. It just, this feels like a story that they just didn't finish in time for the rest of the books. I don't know. It needs to be, in my opinion, it needs to have color, but I also think that's kind of not the point of the thing. I'm sure they would argue it's for artistic reasons, but it's not. I think it's because they didn't finish it and they're just putting it out as is.
I agree with you because I have to say the first part of the story, the black and white, it, like you said last time, it feels unfinished because the black and white in the next Batman story felt more appropriate. I don't know if you felt like that or not.
It did. Well, it did. And I will admit, because I was misinterpreting and thought I was reading a story I had read before, and they were just basically putting the pencils version out.
So, yeah, the next Batman story definitely felt like the black and white was more finished than the first part of the story with Red Hood. So I have to agree with you on that. All right, well, let's move on to our next title for this week. Justice League Last Ride number 2. The issue starts off with Before. Wonder Woman and the Amazons are fighting off hordes of Apocalypse, and Wonder Woman chops off the head of Granny Goodness. Cyborg, Nightwing, and the other Titans are helping evacuate Earth. Darkseid is having nukes sent to Earth via boom tube. And Aquaman is killed when one of them is dropped in the Indian Ocean. Batman and Martian Manhunter are in Darkseid's control center trying to figure out how to shut down the nukes. On Oa, Hal Jordan and Superman are fighting parademons trying to protect the Guardians of the Universe. Darkseid shows up holding dead Guardian bodies. The issue switches to now. Batman, Flash, and Wonder Woman are transporting their prisoner, Lobo, on a spaceship to Apocalypse. Superman, John Stewart, and Hal Jordan are flying escort and even save an alien ship from being pulled into a black hole. Lobo seems happy that he's going to get a front row seat to watching the Justice League die.
I remain intrigued in both halves of the story, but I do wonder if the story is suffering from splitting itself a little too much.
I can tell you, I agree with that, because when I started reading it, I thought, it felt like the beginning of the story was in the future instead of the past. And I was a little confused at first, but when I went back and looked at it, I was like, oh, okay, this is what happened before. I know they stated it, but it didn't feel like it to me. But with Martian Manhunter being alive and stuff, I was like, okay, this happened before. And the present stuff, I don't know, it feels weird.
Yeah, I find myself more, at least this issue, a lot more interested in the past story. I realize that they're meant to go together, so I'm not saying that he should just pick one or the other, but they split this issue like almost in half to the point where I was very invested in getting more of that story, and then we kind of cut it off, and then we just went ahead with the present story, and it was also good, but I was like, left me feeling a little cold. I was like, I was kind of getting into that. I wasn't ready to stop reading that.
It's almost as if he should have spent the whole issue doing the past story instead of cutting to the present and just finish out that story and then moving on to the present in the next issue.
I'd say that might work, but I feel like he's splitting it for a reason. And I could be wrong about this, but my guess is you're splitting it. We've gotten two issues where they've split the past and the present, and I'm sure he's choosing to do it for narrative reasons in the first place. But also, I wonder if he's got so much that he's got to do it, right? That almost half of the story is the past, and if he tried to just do it in a whole issue, it wouldn't be enough.
That's very possible.
I feel like we're going to end up getting this, some version of this split for most of this series, if not the whole thing.
Yeah, that's what it feels like. So that wouldn't surprise me. And this is probably one of those stories that'll read better in a trade than in separate issues.
I totally agree with you, especially just, again, I think the jump to the future wouldn't, or the present, I should say, wouldn't have bothered me, I think, almost at all. If I was about to read the next issue, I'd been like, oh, that's fine. Because I'm not interested in the present story, I am. But knowing that I'm going to read the next part, I would be like, oh, that's fine. I'll get back to that story. It's all good. But knowing that I'm not going to read it for another month, it was like, oh, that's frustrating.
All right, well, let's move on to our next title for this week. Rorschach number 9. The detective goes to the farm to investigate. Every time the detective goes, we get a flashback scene with Meyerson going, hmm. And as the detective makes his way through the house, we get flashback scenes of interactions between Meyerson and the cowgirl. When the detective comes downstairs, he notices the carpet is not cut right. It is not done professionally. The cowgirl appears on the couch as the detective uncovers a large blood stain. She's not really there, of course, but our detective is having a conversation with her in his mind. The detective discovers a bullet hole in the wall behind a Rorschach painting that is hanging too low on the wall. Then the detective discovers a body in a septic tank. And in the coat pocket, the detective discovers a pager. And he calls the last number on it and discovers it's from Ron Wheelock's office. And he's the deputy campaign manager for re-election of President Robert Redford. Now, in the flashback, we find out that Ron Wheelock is bringing them the convention badges they need to get in.
It's very interesting. I am such a big fan of this, of the mystery that the king is telling. And there's one of those things, again, I love the deeper we get into this, kind of remembering back to some of the earlier issues and being like, oh, yeah. Because obviously one of the big things that was raised last issue was how unlikely it was, given everything we've learned about Cowgirl, that she would miss. And we know she did. In last issue, it felt to me like it was implying that maybe she didn't miss. Maybe she did what she was supposed, you know what I mean? Like she wasn't actually meant to hit the guy. That's kind of, I don't know, something felt like there was something else going on. And then we get this, and I'm reminded, oh, that's right. She had an arm injury. Maybe that's why she missed, because, you know, she's never had that before. And now all of a sudden something's throwing her aim off. I don't know, Drew. I mean, I love this mystery.
I know, it's a great mystery. And even the artwork in this, I thought it was cool that you had the detective basically... He was in the same places that Meyerson was as you followed him through the story. And what was interesting was all the ones with Cowgirl in the present with the detective, those scenes were blank, but in the flashbacks, it'd be the exact same scene, but Cowgirl was in them. But with Meyerson, you'd have the detective sitting in the same spot or standing in the same spot that Meyerson was as they went through it. I thought it was really done really well.
Yeah, I totally agree. I really like the seeing the detective at work and seeing him kind of go through. Yeah, it's just good stuff. I love the mystery, and I love seeing the detective slowly uncovering the story as we are. This is just really good. I highly, highly recommend this book to people.
All right, well, let's move on to our next title for this week, The Joker number 4. As Lady Bane battles armored men and makes her way to the Joker, Jim Gordon has Joker in his sights. He contemplates if he should kill the Joker in all the chaos. But he can't. It just feels wrong. Lady Bane gets the Joker first. The Simpsons family shows up, claiming Joker is coming with them. And the Joker asks, what's black and white and red all over? His Joker canisters, and then he triggers the gas. Back at the clock tower in Gotham City, Barbara and Stephanie continue their investigation into Cressida. After sending Jim Gordon off to the airport, she went back to the hotel and swam laps in the pool for an hour. Then she went to the hotel spa and had a 2.5-hour deep tissue massage. Cassie got into her locker where she put her clothes. She had no cell phone, no credit cards, and no ID. Just an Agatha Christie paperback. Cassie also checked her room but found nothing except expensive clothes. When the women call it a night, we see that a Talon shows up at the watchtower. When Jim wakes up, Joker has a little talk with him. He tells Jim he didn't blow up Arkham, but he does have plans for Gotham and Batman, and he's off to Europe for the next part of his plan. Lady Bane enticed Jim Gordon and tells him to go home. Me, I'm not surprised at all that Jim Gordon didn't shoot the Joker, because if he did, it just seemed like it was out of character for him.
Well, it seemed out of character. DC would have painted them. The problem I have with a story like this is that you sort of paint yourself into a corner, right? You either do it, and then you've got a huge mess to figure out. Like, well, now we have to deal narratively with the fact that Jim Gordon killed the Joker. They're not going to do that, right? But then the other hand is like, then what's the point? Like, if you try to convince the reader that the point of the story you're reading is whether or not Jim chooses to kill the Joker, and they correctly assume that that's not going to be the case, because why would it? This is inevitably what you get, where you kind of get like, okay, well, what are we doing?
Yeah, exactly. And I think going forward, we're going to see Jim Gordon chasing after the Joker just to capture him, not to kill him. But I have a feeling the story is going to have him still trying to decide if he wants to kill him or not. And to me, it feels like the story made its decision right here.
I agree only in that if he does end up killing the Joker, which I do not think he'll do, but if he does, then it just becomes frustrating. Like, if you're going to have him do that, why wouldn't he do it earlier? You know what I mean? Then it doesn't, because you could make the argument that Jim is doing ultimately the humanitarian thing, sparing countless future lives by doing it. But if you have him not do it and then change his mind and do it after the Joker's killed another 24 people, your argument weakens, I feel like, a little bit.
Yeah, I agree with you on that. We also had a backup story in this, the Punchline story. Blackgate Penitentiary goes into lockdown because Punchline is found unconscious. The Queen of Spades pays a visit to Punchline in the infirmary, but Orca is on Punchline's side now, and the tables have turned. Then we see Bluebird escapes the burning basement, and she gets a message from Leslie Tompkins telling her to come back to Gotham. I gotta tell you, Orca's turn in this didn't feel right. It didn't feel earned. It felt weird to me.
It felt like it was convenient for Punchline to continue being the smartest person in the room for narrative reasons.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, I don't know. It just felt weird. It wasn't a natural turn or anything like that.
The thing that's driven me nuts with this Punchline story and with her appearance in the main title is, this is subjective to me, but I just feel like the story is trying too hard. They're trying so hard to make her a thing and to make her this amazing villain that you have characters and actions bending over backwards to justify her rise to power. You know what I mean? Like you said, the Orca thing, I see the way that they're trying to explain it, but it doesn't, it's very flimsy. It really just only makes sense if you think about, well, she does it because we want Punchline to win. Then it makes perfect sense. I get very frustrated with stories like that. It just doesn't, to me, it doesn't feel organic. And I know that might feel stupid because it's a fictional story about, you know, superheroes and people wearing fancy costumes, but it just doesn't feel like it's unfolding in a way that would happen, I guess. I don't know how to phrase it exactly, but it just sort of feels like whatever's happening is happening for the sake of the continuing improving circumstances of Punchline. Whatever is best to make her character the best villain ever, that's what's going to happen.
They're trying to make her the next Harley Quinn, and they're forcing it too much. That's the problem with Punchline. It's not organic like Harley Quinn or her story arc over the years has been. So,
Harley was around for a long time. And I'm not saying that Punchline should remain, you know, just a henchman with no voice or, you know, whatever. That's not – but at the same time, it took Harley a long time as a – being around and having more depth and character built up that she's become interesting as a character, right? I mean, not that she wasn't interesting right away, but like, it's a lot of time and depth and story, and all of this together has created this really interesting character that's got a lot of nuance. And it feels like we're trying to like skip ahead and take like the fast lane, so to speak.
Yeah, exactly. All right, well, let's move on to our next title for this week. Detective Comics 1037. Neil Bitterman, the man who killed Sarah Worth, is dead on a rooftop, killed by some sort of parasite. Bruce heads back to Fort Grey after being out as Batman. He runs into Deb, who tells him the police are looking for him. Lydia has been murdered. Bruce is questioned by the GCPD Fort Grey precinct and then is arrested. At the mayor's office, Hugh goes into the alleyway and attacks a man on his cell phone. Looks like he's possessed by some sort of alien parasite. Mr. Worth shows up at the GCPD with a rocket and blows it up. He chases Bruce Wayne into the sewer, and Bruce makes it to one of his micro caves and changes into Batman.
One thing I want to talk about in this story, and also just the Batman titles in general, that I get why the Batman team as a whole is doing this, because it feels intentional, but it's frustrating nonetheless, is the mayor is so deeply incompetent. And I know that I think that that's the point. I think they're trying to show that the dude is out of his depth and is so obsessed with his vendetta that he's not doing his job well. But it's frustrating because they're going all of, I feel like all of the writers are almost doing a too good of a job showing that to the point where it's like, how is this man keeping his job? He's not doing anything right.
Yeah, I know what you mean. He is not making great decisions. And we know Mr. Worth is a criminal. So it's not surprising that he'd have a freaking rocket and blow up a precinct. But man, he is really gunning for Bruce Wayne without even questioning that he didn't do it.
I mean, again, I feel like the author has done enough for all of that to make sense. Like, I buy into that. I agree with you. I mean, he is definitely going purely on emotion, but I feel like that's sort of how they've built his character up to be.
Yeah, because we've seen that in the last several issues. I mean, we've seen him yelling at Mayor Nakano several times. And he's a criminal, and he's a man that gets what he wants. You know, you can tell he's a mobster. But I still find the story interesting. We're getting interactions with all of Bruce's neighbors, and we're getting more Bruce Wayne than we have in the recent past. And I kind of like that, because sometimes, you know, it's just all Batman all the time. It's nice to see Bruce doing things.
I agree. I totally agree. This is my favorite Batman book of all the ones going on right now. This is the one I like the most. I really like the story they're telling. I like one of the things I like with Mobster is that he's clearly antagonistic, but he doesn't feel evil. There's nuance there. You understand why he's clearly acting out of hand, right? And he's not doing what he ought to be doing. Thus the antagonism. But he also it makes sense. You get why he's doing what he's. There's not just like he's not just doing it for the sake of evil.
Exactly. All right. We had a second story, and this was called Gotham Has Heart, and it was a news article written by Deb Donovan on the completion of a new pediatric care wing financed by Lucius Fox's Wayne Enterprises. Deb gives her opinion on this charity event as well as her opinion of Gotham in general.
I didn't fully get the conclusion of this story. I don't know if it was... I'm pretty sure it was Bruce knocking the liquor out of her hand. Was that just like anytime Batman does anything, you assume it's intentional. And so it's like, is he trying to like keep her off of the bottle? Like, I didn't fully get that.
I didn't either. I kind of just went through it and didn't pay that close of attention to it. Cause honestly, it didn't, her news article didn't really interest me that much.
Well, it was one of those things, like, I could sort of kind of see what they were doing to try and build depth to her character. And if you're going to do a very short backup story, it makes sense to use it like that, right? To add a little depth to a character that maybe you aren't going to focus on in the main story. The only thing that surprised me is I don't think she's going to be around a ton. I guess she didn't strike me as somebody that needed depth, to be honest with you.
I can't argue with you on that. We had another story in this called 3 Minutes, which is written by John Ridley, who's been writing the next Batman story. Batman and Robin are pinned down in a kill box by some arms dealers. Batman calls Alfred for help. Mr. Fox is with Alfred in the Batcave, and Lucius uses the turbines of the Batmobile to create an EMP blast that knocks out the arms dealer's electronics for 3 minutes. Alfred and Lucius have a debate about putting young Richard in harm's way. Lucius states he's not doing this for Bruce, but to protect Richard and whoever comes after him. This won't end with Robin. Batman is just going to lure more people into this cult of yours, and someone here has to protect them. So, after reading this story, I was curious, is this another Batman hate from Ridley?
It's a very consistent theme in almost everything we've read, this disdain for Batman. Drew, honestly, not that I necessarily agree with it. Obviously, I like the Batman character, but it's interesting, and it's interesting to have somebody writing that. I question, though, is that we're allowing him to use Lucius Fox as one of his mouthpieces, because, like I said, it feels a little like character assassination, if I'm being honest. This is a retcon. There's no other way to describe this story. This is clearly trying to very seriously reconfigure the lens through which we look at Lucius Fox's help with Batman throughout the years. This is a very serious change.
It is, and we've always seen Bruce and Lucius in the past. We've seen them almost like brothers or something, you know, caring for each other. But this shows that Lucius does not really care for Bruce that much. And he's concerned about Bruce putting Richard and others in harm's way. And he's only there to protect them. He doesn't really care about Bruce, which feels weird when he's running Wayne Enterprises for him.
It's one of those things that doesn't make sense within the context of the stuff before Ridley was writing, because the Lucius Fox that got tortured by Joker was not anti-Batman. And it's one of those things where it worked more for me when it felt like this was him obviously having some trauma coming out of that. But this story is taking it, like, I feel like 3 steps further, where we're like, no, this had been around. That he has always had an anti-Batman slant. And it's like, okay, that's not true. But in previous Lucius Fox stories, that's clearly the direction you're taking this. It's just, it's interesting. It's very interesting to me that
I'm doing this. I'm curious if it was Ridley's idea to have Bruce's money go to the Lucius family, the Fox family.
I want to say no. And the reason I want to say no is because Ridley has had, I would say, two of the most antagonistic views he's had are on Batman, the existence of Batman, and the wealthy. I mean, his disdain for the wealthy class is obvious, I think, in everything that we've read, which I get. I'm not gonna blame him there, but I can't imagine, for that reason, I can't imagine it was his idea. You know what I mean? Like, that would be a little surprising. He does not, to me, he clearly does not like that the Fox family is rich.
Even before they had Bruce's money, they had money. I mean, Lucius is the CEO, so they would still be rich, even
right.
without
no,
Bruce's
no, no.
money.
Yes, I agree with that, Drew, but this is a different level. Getting Bruce's fortune puts you on a mythical level of wealth that I don't think that Ridley would pick for his characters to have.
Okay, I can see your point there. I mean, that puts them on like Bill Gates level, basically.
Yeah. Yeah, oh, if not more than that. I feel like Batman is like mythically wealthy.
So, but it sure is. I thought this story did a lot to bring out what Ridley really thinks of Batman.
Yeah, I agree. Like I said, it's interesting. I'm not opposed to it. Again, I don't necessarily agree, but it's interesting to me that that they're going this route with the Batman team.
All right, well, let's move on to our last title for this week, Wonder Woman number 773. Wonder Woman enters the Fortress of the Valkyries. They are not pleased to see her. They tell Wonder Woman that the Valkyries are not missing, just tired and weary. They are sickened by this routine brutality and are tired of the bounden duty. Thor and his warriors show up, and they follow Diana to the fortress. Thor states if the Valkyries will not return to their duties, maybe they would enjoy a trip to Helheim, realm of the dead. Thor raises his hammer, and Wonder Woman stops him. She goes, "Excuse me, the women here are talking." Wonder Woman and Thor fight until Wonder Woman takes Thor's hammer and smashes it. Wonder Woman reveals it's the dwarf's magical weapons that are making Thor and his men have negative traits. So an agreement was made, a day free of combat, when the Valkyries could breathe and dream, and to commemorate their pact, they inaugurated the first official day of rest to henceforth be known as Thirsty Thor's Day. When Siggy returns, Wonder Woman and Siggy kiss and spend the night together. In the morning, Wonder Woman makes her exit and leaves Asgard to head to Olympus. Siggy catches up to her before she leaves and gives her a sword. When Wonder Woman returns home, she finds it destroyed. I thought this was a good wrap-up to the storyline.
It's phenomenal. What a phenomenal just overall story. I don't feel like there was a weak issue. This was good stuff.
Yeah, it was, and I'm excited the story's continuing on to Olympus and what's going to happen there, because all this mythological stuff ingrained into the story has been really good. And the characters they've got out of this have been really good.
Well, and one thing I really liked, Drew, was the costume change that we got at the end. It's very, obviously it's very brief and subtle, but she's clearly wearing like what feels like a more Greek outfit when she gets to Olympus. And it's like, it feels like we're going to get a similar feeling story next issue, but obviously set in Greek mythology instead. And that's very exciting based on how this arc went.
Yeah. And it's going to be another mystery, it looks like. So I'm excited to explore it. All right. We got a backup story in this, young Diana. In the Amazonian library, Diana shows Cleo the book she found underwater. Cleo discovers that someone has damaged the text to hide something. Diana receives a necklace with a patch of the goddess Iris on it from her mother and Philippus. Diana goes to visit Magala in the mountains of Themyscira, and they talk about the Well of Souls and how the past repeats itself if we choose to forget it. Magala gives Diana some pages she has that she should only show to Cleo, and then Diana gives her Iris, her Eye of Heaven necklace, to Magala. Another good backup story of young Diana, I thought.
Absolutely. So absolutely.
I've been really enjoying that too. The art style, love it, because it fits a young Diana story. Definitely. As opposed to what's in the regular story. So I just like it a lot. All right, well, that wraps up our comic books talk for this week. Let's take a short break, and when we come back, we'll talk our CW shows.
Welcome to Dr. Geek's Laboratory.
Hello, everyone. Dr. Geek here with a shout-out to all the scientists who worked tirelessly to bring a COVID-19 vaccine into reality. Let's face it, creating something of this magnitude is a miracle worthy of Dr. McCoy himself. And now, Dr. Geek needs you to do your part. Remember, each shot is one small step back to normal, one giant leap to putting the pandemic behind us. We can do this. For more information, visit vaccines.gov to find your nearest provider.
And we're back. Let's talk Batwoman, Season 2, Episode 15, Armed and Dangerous. The episode opens up with a recap of Luke Fox trying to stop Eli from stealing a car. The crows show up, and when Luke pulls out his phone to show them evidence that he is not behind the attempted car theft, the crows shoot him. Agent Tavaroff is under investigation for shooting Luke Fox. He claims Luke pulled out a gun, and the body cam footage is under review. Ryan and Mary go to the Batcave. Mary is going to save Luke's life with the Desert Rose. Mary goes through Dr. Evelyn Rhyme's patient files, finding folders on her dad, Kate, and Mary. Batwoman tracks down Eli and gets the real story of how Luke was shot. Then Batwoman goes after Agent Tavaroff and gets rammed by a crow's SUV. Footage of Luke pulling a gun runs on the news. Sophie and Ryan work together to get the original footage of Luke pulling out his cell phone before it's deleted from the crow's server. Mary distracts the guards to Luke's hospital while a masked person enters and gives Luke a liquid form of the Desert Rose. Jacob confronts Tavaroff and Tavaroff pistol whips him. Tavaroff is going to kill the commander by giving him 3 injections of snakebite. Batwoman shows up and takes them all out. Jacob Kane gives a press conference about Luke's innocence, the crows responsible, and the disbanding of the crows. Alice tells Jacob that Kate is alive and under the control of Black Mask. Were you surprised by the dismantling of the crows?
A little, not. Honestly, I'm not surprised that it happened this season. I'm surprised it happened immediately. That seemed awfully fast, but then again, this show isn't exactly known for phenomenal pacing decisions. So, I don't know. Yes and no, I guess. It definitely felt like they were going to shut the crows down this season, I will say. I did not think it was this episode, though.
After watching this episode, I was like, okay, so they're getting rid of the crows. I wonder if they're going to wrap up Jacob Kane's storyline and get him off the show after this season.
I do wonder that. I wonder if this is their way to slowly get rid of, you know, the Kane part of the story so that they can focus more on Ryan, which would be good. But, I mean, it's hard to – this also is very clearly inspired by the past year. So it's tough. I don't know. I feel like they would have done this a story similar to this regardless of the change in Batwoman.
That's true. I could see that too.
But maybe not. I don't know. Maybe the fact that specifically it is a now a Black Batwoman made them more likely to make this decision. I don't know. I feel like we're getting too far in the weeds there on what ifs. But it felt inevitable pretty early on. Ryan was so antagonistic towards the crows in a way that felt like it was the writers and not just her. Which I get. I mean, clearly there was some systematic issues there with the crows, so I understand. One thing I think a better show would have done is Tavaroff not being just 100% complete heel. I think you make the same point, and I think it becomes a more poignant point if he's not just a total D-bag, right? I get what they're going for, where they're trying to make – they're clearly making a point with him. But I think they're trying to make it easy to root against him because he's so unquestionably bad in all regards. But that's not real life, right? I mean, sure, some people can be pretty bad. Maybe some people are mostly bad. But when I feel like one of the things that they wanted to highlight – was the injustice of the fact that Luke did nothing wrong. This cop shot him anyway, and then Luke was going to get blamed by the media. Now, obviously, they communicated that anyway with the story, but wouldn't it frustrate you more if the cop wasn't – like, I feel like you show the injustice of the system more if he's just a guy that made a really terrible decision, right? He sees – Luke reach into his coat and acts way too quickly and shoots. That's unquestionably a bad choice. But what if you leave it just at that, right? The guy makes a bad choice, But instead of getting punished for that bad choice, they just kind of let it go because, otherwise speaking, he's a good guy. Isn't that frustrating? I feel like I would be frustrated by that, right? Like, in a good way. Like, the show is showing this is how it kind of works, is a guy makes an unquestionably bad decision, something that he shouldn't be doing in that job, and he's going to get away with it because otherwise, in other regards, he's, you know, a pretty good guy.
That's more to true life stuff we've actually seen in true life before. Cops shooting off their gun too quickly. We've seen that before in real life.
I just feel like that would have been, like you said, more true to life, but also nuanced in a way that would honestly get me more invested in the injustice to Luke's character. I know that seems backwards because, in a way, you're making that character less villainous, but I feel like that highlights the injustice of the whole thing more. The fact that, you know what I mean, that the guy just kind of gets away with it. In this case, it's obviously frustrating that the guy just gets away with it because he's just a bad guy. Like, he's unquestionably a villain. I don't know.
Yeah, he was much more of a villain than this, and they could have portrayed him more of a gray area kind of cop. Would have probably felt more true to life. I agree with you on that. All right, well, let's move on to our next episode for this week. Superman and Lois, Season 1, Episode 9, Loyal Subjects. Lois, Chrissy, and Clark dig deeper into why Morgan Edge is still in Smallville. Clark runs into an old classmate, Emily Fawn, at a local cafe. She tells Clark she is doing well because of Morgan Edge's special executive program. Clark hears a bank robbery in Mexico and quickly responds to Superman, but is having problems with his breathing because of the aerosol kryptonite from last episode. One of the gunmen shoots Superman until he passes out unconscious. Superman wakes up a few minutes later and takes care of the rest of the bad guys. When Edge takes out a big ad in the Smallville newspaper looking for more recruits, Lois Lane barges into his conference room and calls him out. Lois comes home to find Clark putting ice on his bruises he received from the bullets in Mexico. Jordan starts sneezing into his hands and ice forms. Clark realizes Jordan has been infected with kryptonite gas also. And when Jordan gets worse, Clark flies him to the Fortress of Solitude. The kryptonite must be burned out of his system. Emily Fawn and another dude show up at the Kent farmhouse. Emily uses her heat vision to try and kill Lois. Sam Lane keeps them busy while Jonathan and Lois run to the barn. Jonathan has John Henry Irons' guns stashed away in case of emergency. Kyle Cushing shows up, claiming he is following Emily and her companion. Jonathan uses the gun on Emily, and then Kyle uses heat vision on the gun in Jonathan's hands. Superman shows up as Kyle is going to kill Lois. Morgan Edge calls out Superman. He's got powers too, and he's wearing a black Kryptonian costume with an emblem that looks a lot like the one that belongs to Zod. And the big question is, are the people being infected with powers actually being infected with the spirits of Kryptonians? So that was what I was curious about after watching this episode. Is he just giving them powers, or are they actually the spirits of Kryptonians that are inhabiting human bodies? What's your opinion on that, Cletus?
I think it's clearly the latter. I feel like the show has almost explicitly stated that.
All right. Well, that answers that question.
I'm just saying, I feel like, I think it is definitely the latter.
They didn't actually come out and say Morgan Edge was Zod, but I'm guessing that's going to get revealed next episode.
I don't know, because he had the line that called Superman his brother, which Zod is not. Superman doesn't have a brother, so I don't know. I assumed he was Zod, but that line threw me off a little bit.
Yeah, I bet he meant brother Kryptonians, what I thought when he said
that. What my guess is that's probably what he meant, but I feel like it's unquestionably at minimum a red herring because I think the show wants us to at least question that line.
Yeah, I can see that.
I like this. I was joking with my girlfriend. I loved the frost breath sneeze. That was such a little detail that I just love. It's just one of those things where you're like, oh, that makes sense that would happen. I kind of like that.
Yeah, I'm just hoping they used hand sanitizer after that.
It was such a funny, I really liked that little touch of, well, that makes sense if Superman ever, you know, had the sniffles, that something like that might happen. This show continues to be, I think, one of the better, if not the best, CW ones going on right now. And I think, and I talked about this before, I think the way the show is shot, it feels a lot more cinematic. It feels higher, like a higher budget, I'm assuming it probably is. But the other thing that I think it also benefits from is it's the least episodic, I feel like. It's still got a little bit of the episode-to-episode DNA in it, but it's the least of any of the shows. It's very, I feel it's the most serialized version of any of the CW shows, where it's more like what we would see on Disney Plus or HBO Max, where it's a season-long story. You know what I mean? And we're getting bits of the story and not just this week on Superman and Lois.
Exactly. And I'm really enjoying the show too. I like the fact that it's like that.
For certain shows, the episodic and semi-formulaic nature works. Like with Legends, that show to me makes sense to make it episodic, because that's sort of the nature of the show, is like, what quirky, goofy skit/bit are we going to do this week? That makes sense to do that episodically. But the more serialized version of what we're getting with Superman Lois, I think, is clearly well suited to this show. But Flash, I think, would benefit a lot from being more like that. I would argue that it was. I mean, not that it didn't have standalone Villain of the Week episodes in season one. It certainly did. But I felt like that one felt more serialized, a little more straightforward in their vision for the show. And I feel like it's missing that, and the other shows are missing that too. Now, I don't necessarily need a full 22-episode season of just one storyline, but even if you did, like, you split the season in two, but they were less episodic, more serialized, I think the other shows would benefit a lot from that.
I agree with you. All right, well, let's move on to our next episode for this week, The Flash, Season 7, Episode 12, Goodbye Vibrations. Cisco and Camilla tell Barry, Iris, and Caitlin they are leaving Central City tomorrow. Camilla is opening an art gallery, and Cisco is taking a job with Argus in Star City. A new Meta walks into a bank and has some sort of mental influence, and has the banker writing her a cashier's check for $10 million. Caitlin discovers that the new Meta can make a person loopy and susceptible to suggestion. Cisco realizes it's Rainbow Raider 2.0. When Rainbow Raider strikes a jewelry store, Flash and Vibe show up to stop her. While Flash is rescuing someone, Rainbow Raider zaps Cisco and makes him one happy guy. When the Flash goes to Ferris Air to see what Rainbow Raider is up to, Cisco turns on some weird cat thing that blocks his vision. When Cisco turns it off, Rainbow Raider is right there to hit Flash with her power, and she sends him away to have some me time. When the Flash returns to Star Labs, it's party time with Cisco. Flash breakdancing. Yeah, this show has jumped the shark. Chester is able to counteract Rainbow Raider's power, and Rainbow Raider's plan is to drop money and jewelry on the city using a blimp. Flash, Vibe, and Allegra are able to stop her before she does. And instead of going to Iron Heights, Flash has promised that he will recommend any sentence Rainbow Raider receives she can work off with Mayor Sampson's Economic Development Committee. The blimp's automatic pilot jams, and it's up to Cisco to save it from crashing into the football stadium. Cisco passes the torch to Chester by giving him all his designs and stuff for Star Labs. The episode ends with karaoke to Lady Gaga's Poker Face. We have an after clip with Cecile. She hears a voice calling her name. She looks in the mirror and sees a reflection of herself wearing a gold mask.
The karaoke scene was definitely fun, and I get, you know, why they did it, in a sense that, you know, Cisco is a fun character. You want to do something that fits with him. And I can definitely see people enjoying it, but that felt so self-indulgent to me, Drew. And I know that might be an unnecessary complaint, but it felt like it was in there more for the cast to enjoy themselves than it was to make a good show.
I have to agree with you, because it definitely felt like something the cast... It felt like something the cast would do off camera. That's what it felt like to me.
I don't want to sound like a curmudgeon that the cast can't have fun and enjoy themselves. They absolutely should and can. But also, you need somebody, I don't know, maybe the showrunner, for example, to be on and be like, yeah, that's great, and we can do that, but let's also maybe not put it in the actual episode. I don't know. That's just me. I just feel like decisions are being made on this show that are what is most amusing for the cast to do and not necessarily what would actually make the best show.
Another thing I didn't like in the show is, again, once again, the villain is acting villainous during the show, but when we get towards the end of the episode, they're not really a villain anymore. You know what I mean? It doesn't feel like they're actually stopping villains. They're like becoming friends with them, and everything's all lovey-dovey. I don't know. It's just...
This one was just straight... This one, Drew, was so pants on head stupid. I got very frustrated because it was just like they were so okay with what. Well, your intentions were so good. It doesn't matter that you broke the law because you were breaking them for a good reason. So we're in fact going to actually give you more. Like, we're going to reward you for this. We're going to put you in charge of decisions for the city. Oh, and again, it was one of those things where it was clearly, it was so obviously a mouthpiece for the writer's room and not the characters. You know what I mean? Like when Flash is just like, oh, you're taking a stand for the people who don't have a voice and can't help themselves. I'm like, he's not saying that. That is the writers talking at me. It's just, I get frustrated because it's not, I don't necessarily disagree with a lot of stuff that the writers, I think I agree for the most part with a lot of their views, but I don't like being condescended to. And that's always the way it feels. It feels like I'm being sort of just like finger wagged, like, well, you should think this. And if you don't, you're a bad person. Like, well, how about you just do a damn superhero show? I don't know.
I know it's exactly what you mean. Tell us a superhero story. Don't be preaching at us.
The thing is, I feel like you can incorporate your political views. Like, Watchmen is unquestionably political. There's no doubt it is, but it doesn't do it in a way that's like, to me, it didn't feel like it was standing on a soapbox telling me how I should think. It was just putting it out there. It was like, hey, this is things that are happening. These are things that are very obviously applicable to what's going on in the real world, but maybe you can take from it what you will. We're going to put all of this out there and you can interpret it and decide for yourself. I feel like we get so often with the CW shows is we're instead told what we should be thinking. Like, it's not here. This is stuff that's going on out in the real world. Decide for yourself based on the stuff that we put out here, how you think you should feel. Instead, it's like, this is how you should feel. This is what you should be doing. This is what everyone should be doing. And if they're not, they're a bad person.
That's what good storytelling does, is it. It doesn't preach at you like that. It incorporates it with the story where it makes sense. And that's the Flash is bad at that. Supergirl is bad at that.
The worst. Supergirl, I would argue, is the worst. Even like Batwoman's bad, but I feel like Batwoman's just a bad show. Supergirl, I feel like, is the most egregious of any of the shows in terms of preaching to you.
I totally agree with you. And it gets really frustrating, especially with the Flash, because how good of a show it used to be and what it is now. And I blame the showrunner on that.
It's just one of the things where I'm of the opinion that you can incorporate that stuff in there and do it in a way that's not talking down to the audience, because I agree that, you know, like the class system is clearly not working. Okay. I don't disagree with that, but don't talk down to me with it. Like, the reason I don't dislike what I'm getting in Ridley's stuff, his Batman stuff, for example, his stuff on class, is because I don't feel like he's telling me how I should think. He's clearly putting his own opinion out there, unquestionably, but I feel like he's allowing you to decide whether you agree with that or not.
Unfortunately, I don't think Flash is going to get any better this season. I think we're going to get much of the same through the rest of the season.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's just, I think this is what the show is now. It's just so stuck in its formula. Where, again, the other thing that frustrated me with this, Drew, just talking about this episode, was every episode has to be some lesson learned and character building thing. Like, Cisco, the line where he was like, oh, you mean you guys don't want me to leave? No, Cisco, they've been your friends for almost a decade. Of course they're sad that you're leaving. Are you kidding me? It was just like, what are we doing? Why does every episode have to be like this, where characters just apparently never had any emotional learning growing up? What? Gosh, Drew, it just drives me nuts. One time, I would love for every character on the show to actually act as though they are the adults that they are and just, you know, go about their lives for one episode, instead of each episode being one character not learning some basic social cue or some basic behavior that you or whatever that you should have, and them learning that lesson by the end of the episode.
I totally agree with you.
I mean, it was just so unnecessary. I talk a lot about how arbitrary and frivolous some of these plots are. The whole Cisco feeling the cold shoulder thing was so dumb. It was so dumb. It was, again, it was just one of those things where, like, why would he think that? I could see that happening if they were being more overtly cold shoulder to him, but they were still doing helpful stuff. And again, they have a nearly decade long friendship. They describe each other as their best friends. Of course they're sad you're leaving, my guy. Come on.
Just like Flash packing up his stuff, that was, and Cisco being upset about that was stupid.
So stupid.
All right, well, let's move on to our last episode for this week. DC Legends Tomorrow, Season 6, Episode 5, The Satanist Apprentice. The episode begins with Astra having a bad day. Not enough money for the cab, only being able to buy bread, and a racist neighbor hassling her for being in his neighborhood. A bad day turns into bad weeks. John's house is in need of some serious repairs, and Astra cannot get a job because the world thinks she's 15. In the attic, she comes upon a painting of Aleister Crowley, whom John has once summoned from hell to learn information and then trapped in a painting. He promised to teach Astra magic. Sarah Lance meets the alien behind her kidnapping, Bishop, and he states he was to save humanity, and he gives Sarah a cure for her poison. Astra uses magic to trap John in the painting and free Crowley. He has 12 hours to teach Astra magic before he goes back into the painting. When the legends show up at John's house, Astra turns them into objects like Beauty and the Beast. Crowley has Astra create a magic amulet into which she needs to steal a soul. Astra goes after the racist neighbor but can't go through with it. Crowley steals the soul instead and then uses the amulet to turn Astra into a singing cartoon character. Astra's mother, Natalie, once created a cleansing spell for John if he ever got out of control. Astra uses this cleansing spell on Crowley.
Also, at the end of the episode, we learned that it also affected John. So we've got John is effectively magicless as well at the moment.
Yeah, I failed to mention that, but yeah, that happened.
Well, the reason I mention it is because I felt like the episode hinted that he may have taken more stock in what Crowley was telling him about this source of power out in space than he let on.
Oh, yeah. After seeing this episode and them talking about that magic in space and John losing his magic, I totally assumed that John was going to be getting that magic later in the season. So,
I loved the animated part of this episode so much to the point where I kind of wish there was an animated version of Legends. It was so good.
it was fun. It was very fun. I loved this episode. I thought it was a fun episode. We haven't really focused on Astra that much, so it was nice for an episode to focus on her for once. I mean, we had some stuff with Sarah, but they didn't split away from the Astra story that much with the Sarah stuff, I didn't think. It didn't intrude on the story that much.
My only nitpick, and this is, again, this is subjective, I truly feel like she's the weakest cast member in terms of acting. It's not that big of a deal because it's a comedy show, but I was telling my girlfriend, we were talking about it because she feels similarly. And I feel like what it is she tries, I feel like she tries to go tongue in cheek, but there's just a little bit too much seriousness in it that it doesn't quite hit the right tone. Like it feels like she's trying just a little too hard in a show that is definitely not trying very hard.
I don't think we had Mick in this episode at all, did we?
Yeah, I don't think we had him last. Did we? I don't think we had him last issue either, or episode, right?
No, I thought he was more prevalent in last issue because he was the one leading the charge to find Sarah.
Oh, you're right. You're right. Yeah. I forgot that was how that one ended. Yep. I was in my head. There was an episode in between that, but obviously there wasn't.
So I'm fully expecting him to show up next episode trying to rescue Sarah, at least because didn't he go off to go rescue Sarah by himself or something?
It's possible it's next episode. I wonder if that doesn't happen whenever this show. I feel like he's going to be in the end of the show. We know that he's getting written off. I suspect that he'll pop up towards the resolution, I think.
Well, I guess that does make sense.
I think I could be wrong. I obviously could be wrong, but I feel like if he pops up next episode, it would be more like on the way and them exploring that they clearly want to do a little bit of the dynamic between him and the alien. So we might see some sort of like subplot with those two, but I don't think this is purely speculation. I don't think we'll see him actually show up where Sarah's at next episode. That feels too soon.
Okay. All right. Well, that wraps up another episode for this week. Do you have a shout out, Cletus?
For other arguably more engaging superhero shows, Loki's out. Really enjoying it. Really, really like the first two episodes. Very curious to see where they go.
I'm glad to hear that. I haven't watched it yet, so hopefully I'll get some time to watch it soon.
It's weird that they're putting them out on Wednesdays. It doesn't matter. It's odd to me that it's Wednesdays, but whatever. The show is really good. I'm liking it a lot. And it makes me excited for when we get into the HBO Max lineup of DC stuff, because we've seen that they can put out some really high quality stuff too.
Yes, I'm excited about that too. It just seems like it's been a long time since we've gotten any of that stuff. Been stuck with the CW stuff for too long.
Yeah.
All right, and for my shout out, I'm going to shout out about Batman Death in the Family. After reading the story with Jason Todd and then seeing some of his flashbacks, if you haven't read that story before, I suggest checking it out. It's an important time in Batman's life, I think. I guess it kind of holds a special place. All right, if you'd like to comment on anything we've talked about tonight, you can reach us at our feedback line, 317-564-9133. Leave us a message, or you can email us at earthstationdcu@gmail.com. All right, Cletus, coming up next week, we've got the next Batman Second Son, Batman Earth 1, Volume 3, Superman Red and Blue, Supergirl Woman of Tomorrow, DC Pride, Catwoman, Nightwing, The Flash, and then, of course, our CW shows, Batwoman, Superman and Lois, The Flash, and Legends Tomorrow. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you next time.
For you and the power you possess in your satin tights. fighting for your rights, and the old red, white, and blue.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network. Be part of the crew and help support our shows by donating to our ESO Patreon or by shopping for the TeePublic store, which can all be found at www.esonetwork.com. The ESO Network, your station for all things geek.